Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable, and welcome to the Roundtable panel. Very glad to have you all with us. Thanks for everybody for doing something in the lockbox this morning. If you did something, and if you haven't, you still have time. WAMC.org. We very much appreciate all of you. We made our goal. We're very happy. We have a lot more to go, but we'll tackle that as we go down the road. WAMC.org. The music we heard was the Wood Brothers, their new album, Heart is the Hero, playing Arrowwood Farms Brewery in Acard, New York on June 15th, and Summer Stage at Treehouse Brewing Company in Deerfield, Massachusetts on the 18th of June. The Wood Bros, BROS.com. For more information, you can also see the playlist posted on our website at WAMC.org/roundtable. Full panel this morning going to 11 o'clock. Let me introduce the group to you. Stuart Rice, Honorary Chair at the University of Massachusetts Amherst College of Information and Computer Sciences and Faculty Associate at the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Fran Berman, good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Joe. I am always struck that I can't tell the difference for whether you're doing an FUND drive or an FUN drive.
Yeah.
So you just make the fun drive fun. Just
well,
saying.
Thank you very much. But I think if you asked any of us before, during, or after, we would say it's a fund drive. with occasionally a little fun. Yes.
Yes.
We are very happy. We certainly do have fun, but the idea is, yeah, get the money. Get the money and then get back to regular programming.
Money.
That's the main goal. But thank you. It's so good to hear your voice. Thank you for being with us. We welcome the semi-retired editor at large, columnist, editorial writer for the Times Union, Jay Jochnowitz. Hello, Jay. How are you?
I'm well. Oh, let me just pull this a little closer. There
yes,
we go.
There you go. Excellent. Much
okay.
better. Yeah.
I'm well. And I'm the only thing I feel bad about is we only have an hour today, and I don't know if that's going to be as cathartic as I need it to be, but we'll give it a try.
You know, we can make 47 minutes pretty damn cathartic,
okay.
I think. I believe we can. We'll certainly do our best. We've been doing some lightning rounds this week and getting through as many topics as we can, and I'm sure we'll do that again today.
I was excited, by the way, when you mentioned that there's a Mad Magazine.
Mad Magazine
exhibit
at the Norman Rockwell Museum. It opens tomorrow. And yeah, we're very excited. We're going to be doing a special on that, and we're very excited.
This
yeah.
is cool.
Yeah, really neat stuff.
An editor for Mad Magazine surprised me one day by putting in a submission years ago of an op-ed, and it was very funny, and it said Mad Magazine, and I'm like, oh my, you know, this is like really cool.
This is our...
and
right.
John Ficarra, he and I became friends of a sort, and he submitted on a fairly regular basis, and it's cool.
I would have to check, but I think John is on our list of people that we're going to be talking to.
Oh, awesome. He's
that.
A great guy.
I don't know that for sure, but I'm pretty sure of that. Aaron Pasitti, I know, is on our list of people to talk to today. He is a professor of economics at Siena College, and we welcome him to the program. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well. I'm happy to be here. I'm sad to hear that Jay didn't think that my two op-eds in the Times Union were funny, but that's okay. They're not supposed to be funny.
I say this often, but I just want you to know this, that it's not a contest.
I know. Economists aren't supposed to be funny.
It's not a contest.
They were engaging.
Thank you. There you go. Yeah. Right on there. I was joking. Yeah, no, I don't. Like, when economists make people laugh, you should probably start discrediting them.
John Ficarra was hired as an assistant editor for Mad in 1980. Shortly after his debut as a contributing writer, he became Mad's editor-in-chief in 85, and a position he retained until 2018. He will be with us on our special broadcast.
Fantastic.
And I'd love to tell you when that airs, but because we have a fun drive in the middle of it, I have no idea. We'll wait. We'll see.
Show me the money.
That's right. Exactly. Exactly. All right, everybody. Let's get started and get to the get us to the panel and talk about the items of the day. So let us begin with our good friend Aaron Pasitti. The new job numbers are out. The May jobs report is out. We're finding out that the economy is losing some momentum. Growth hasn't yet slowed to the point that it would be a concern to policymakers, but it might soon if current trends continue. What do we make of that, Aaron Pasitti?
Well, there's a lot of mixed signals happening right now, particularly with this morning's release of the employment report. So as you mentioned, there are some very early indications that economic growth is starting to slow just a little bit. You've seen slowing growth in personal incomes, saving rates, spending rates, industrial production, the Purchasing Managers Index. But these are very, very, very small changes in those variables. So I don't think it's anything to worry about. I don't think a recession is on the horizon. And I say that with particular attention paid to this morning's job report, which came in substantially stronger than what a lot of forecasters were predicting. The consensus estimate was that the economy would add 190,000 jobs in May, but they added 272,000 jobs in May. So almost a 50% increase over what was forecasted. But interestingly, the unemployment, despite the economy adding 272,000 jobs, which is up from 175,000 in May or April, the unemployment rate went up. So I think a question on a lot of people's minds is, how can an economy add jobs but have the unemployment rate go up? This is not something we see very often, but we see it around turning points or periods of volatility. So the first thing to note is that the number of jobs created comes from a survey of businesses that the Bureau of Labor Statistics does. The unemployment report comes from a survey of households. So you're asking two different groups about their employment prospects. Normally, they move in tandem with one another. So that explains part of it. The second problem is that there's still continued pandemic-related disruptions associated with sampling. Seasonal patterns have become less reliable. But on the whole, without getting into the minutiae of the different surveys and how they calculate that, it's worth pointing out that we've had over 2 years, 24 months of consecutive job growth where the unemployment rate has remained at 4% or below. This month also showed that wages for the average worker increased 4.1%, and that's greater than the 2.7% inflation rate. So we're seeing incomes outpace inflation, which is a welcome development. Job gains were broad-based. They affected all sectors of the economy. So that's the good news. But the bad news and what you're kind of seeing with some market reactions is that all of this points to inflation remaining more stubborn than the Federal Reserve would like. So the implication is that the Fed is going to keep interest rates higher for longer, which means borrowing costs are going to go up for households and businesses. So interest rates on your credit card, auto loan rates, mortgage rates, student loan interest rates, commercial interest rates are all going to be higher for longer. And the whole point of that is to slow economic activity, to kind of not send the economy into a recession, but slow growth rates so that inflation gets back down to the Fed's 2% target. So policy-wise, this puts Biden in a very difficult position with the upcoming election because you have consumers who are upset about inflation. But those same consumers are also upset about the cure for inflation, which is higher borrowing costs. So I know this is something we're going to talk about later, and I've got a whole separate set of notes on that. But in terms of the job report, it is a positive sign that workers are still able to access jobs. Workers have bargaining power to ask for wages that are in excess of inflation. And that's good news. And that should be a tailwind for Biden's reelection campaign. And he should be pounding his fist at every opportunity, not just the first Friday of every month, talking about, under my administration, we've added more jobs than the entirety of the Trump administration, probably even close to double that. So that can be a tailwind for Biden, and that's a good thing. But as we'll discuss later, he's also facing a lot of headwinds, particularly with inflation.
Fran, I say this. Hey. I say this.
I was just going to ask Aaron a question.
Okay, go ahead. And then I have a question for you about what Aaron said, but go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, this is a beginner's mind question, Aaron, so I hope you don't mind it. But what does this all mean for the average consumer? You know, how can they... what does it mean? Are things harder, or is it easier, or, you know, does the housing market loosen up, or jobs harder to get?
No,
do you see this when you go to the grocery store? What does all this really mean?
Yeah, that's a good question. And unfortunately, it depends, you know, which consumer and what those consumers are looking at. So let me take the, you know, mile high view, and that is for the average consumer, it has been easier to get a job. Consumers are more confident in their ability to switch jobs and get a higher wage at another job. Consumers have, or workers have, a lot of bargaining power because the unemployment rate's low, so they're able to demand and secure wage increases, which we've seen. So that's good news. The bad news comes from the fact that since the labor market's so strong, and since we have still all of these COVID and geopolitical forces that are keeping inflation higher than we want, that consumers still feel pinched when they go to the grocery store, if they need to buy a new car and borrow money to do that, if they want to buy a new house. So in a lot of ways, the labor market is working for the average worker and consumer by giving them, solid, secure jobs with wages that outpace inflation. But at the same time, those consumers are also facing higher than normal grocery bills and higher cost of borrowing. So it's kind of a mixed bag. And in terms of policy in the election, consumers tend to focus more on the negatives, right? You take your job security as a given. You take that for granted. If you're getting a 3% wage increase or a 4% wage increase, you take that for granted. But you focus on the fact that, geez, my grocery bill's 9% higher than it was a couple years ago. And they tend to focus on that, which can certainly skew people's belief about how the economy is actually performing.
Yeah, I mean, I always wonder, and this is a question from Mathland, all these factors, are they correlations or causations? Is the job growth, does that correlate with the fact that we happen to see high grocery prices, or it's impossible for my kids to buy a house? Is there some causal connections?
That's an excellent question. And with respect to housing, with respect to energy prices like gasoline and heating fuel, and with respect to groceries, that has everything to do with COVID and Putin's invasion of Ukraine upsetting oil and international grain markets.
Oh, wow.
It has nothing to do with the strong labor market. The strong labor market puts some mild upward pressure on inflation, but the fact that consumers are facing higher grocery bills comes from two sources: Putin's invasion of Ukraine, and Ukraine is a major grain exporter. So the fact that Russia was destroying silos, setting fire to grain fields, and destroying the ports that sent those grains to international markets meant that the supply of grain went down, and that's a major input to a lot of processed foods. On top of that, you have enormous market concentration in the processed food industry. General Mills, Nestle, Coca-Cola, Kellogg's. There's like nine firms that control like 90% of what we buy at the supermarket. So, sure, they face higher input costs, but they also don't face competition. So they've been able to raise prices and increase their profits. So the increase in grocery prices has nothing to do with Biden policies. It has nothing to do with Trump policies, for that matter. It has to do with the pandemic, and it has to do with Putin invading Ukraine.
Oh, God, that's amazing. And apologies to Joe and everyone for hijacking the roundtable.
No, these are excellent questions.
Able to talk to an economist.
Well, let me ask the mathematician the question of how sacred are these numbers that are reported? I mean, how true are they? What evil lurks in the hearts of fours, fives, and sixes?
Sure.
Which one of us do you want to talk to?
Well, I want to talk to both of you. I'll go to Aaron first, okay. And then we'll go to... And Jay, I promise you'll get to talk on the show.
I'm fine.
Okay, all right.
I'm actually trying to understand this, so this is good.
So all of these government data releases come from surveys, and the Bureau of Labor Statistics publishes their unemployment report the first Friday of every month. And that's based on the survey responses they get on the second week of the preceding month. But as more survey information comes in over the next month, those numbers get revised. So same thing with GDP. The Bureau of Economic Analysis makes three separate. They have their initial estimate, or they have their advanced estimate, their revised estimate, and their final estimate. So there's three revisions to the initial release of GDP numbers. And there are multiple revisions to the number of jobs created and the unemployment rate that the Bureau of Labor Statistics produced today. So the answer is, this gives us a good barometer of where the economy is, but these numbers do get revised. And again, with pandemic-era disruptions and weird fluctuating seasonal patterns that we didn't see before the pandemic, expect these numbers to be heavily revised, probably in a way that is less favorable than we would like to see.
Fran, your thoughts on the validity always of these numbers?
I only have a generic response to this, not a specific one. So I would trust Aaron. But all numbers that you read in the paper are given in context. And they're not always exactly accurate. And they don't always give you the story or the answer that they want. There are a lot of assumptions for these numbers, I would imagine. There's a lot of assumptions that are made about specific industries, about the economy, about the population, about what's a job and what's not a job, what goes into your grocery bill, things like that. And so whatever numbers you see are educated guesses by experts, of course. But that doesn't necessarily mean they're completely accurate representations of reality, whatever that is. And we always have to look at numbers that way. We still build bridges that don't fall down. We still create roads. We can still split the atom. But all numbers are really within a context, and it's important for us to know that.
Finally, we get to Jay.
What are we talking
about?
And
he's the only one wearing a tie.
Yeah, I know.
Okay,
yeah,
so
the rest
I end
of
up.
The hour is yours, Jay.
Yeah. So I end up with questions too. I'm even before beginner's mind. I don't know what that would be, but so here's my curmudgeonly comment from the sideline. Reading the Wall Street Journal, it's telling me, it's using rather subjective language that I thought the economy is losing momentum. I would say that if I was looking at all this, isn't the economy cooling down?
Yeah.
And isn't that exactly what the Fed has been looking for? And isn't that what we've been hearing is the thing that will help us all and take us to the promised land? So if there's a sweet spot, what about today? And all the cumulative stuff that we're looking at would look different to put this in a sweet spot.
Yeah. You know, pre-Trump, the Wall Street Journal's headlines and the language in their articles was fairly objective. Mm. That's the paper that I follow most closely. After Trump, you started to see these, not on their editorial page, that's separate, but in their news analysis, these you start to see a little bit of, like you said, subjective language in this bias that's losing momentum. No, the economy's growth rate is cooling off, and that's exactly what the Fed has been trying to do. It's like landing a plane, right? You want the plane to come down at a gradual pace so you don't go like that, or you just miss the runway entirely. So that headline should have said, Fed's policy objectives working to bring the economy to a soft landing. Consumers, businesses should rejoice. Mm-hmm. But that's not what it said.
So is there anything that could be better about this in terms of, I guess, the Fed's perspective as well as ours? I mean, I know I would like the cost of Oreos to come down I could consider them again. But but that's not happening. They're still, you know, whatever they are, like $4.50 a bag? It's crazy.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's...
it's a great point, though,
it
Jay.
Is. No, it is.
I was in Penn Station the other day, and I picked up a bag of Milano's, Pepperidge Farm Milano cookies, $7.25. I was like, how does this... When did it become a buck a cookie?
I saw a rat at Walgreens today in the parking lot carrying an unopened bag of Reese's peanut butter cups. And it wasn't quite Pizza Rat from New York, but it was pretty good for Gilderland Rat. That has nothing to do with anything. I just had a show.
No, I thought you were going to say that the actual item was to the amount that it would be a Class B felony.
Yeah,
it was one package, but you know it just shows. You know, somebody threw it out for God's sakes. Anyway, I don't know.
No, but you bring up a good point with the Oreos thing, and that is people don't buy houses very often, and when they do buy houses, they usually have a fixed rate mortgage. So, the fluctuation in the price of housing is not affecting homeowners right now, right? It's only for prospective buyers. Cars are purchased infrequently. So, the increase in new car prices and higher interest rates don't affect people except those who are buying a new car. And that's a small share of the population. Mm-hmm. But everybody buys groceries, and they buy them on a weekly basis. So that's what they see. Those are the anchor points that that consumers see and base their, you know, those are the anchor points that kind of guide consumers' perspective on the macro economy. Mm-hmm. And Biden's messaging on this has been pretty, pretty pathetic. Now, the cause of that has been entirely Putin's invasion of Ukraine, mm-hmm. because of the massive reduction in the supply of world grain, like corn and wheat and soybeans, all of these things that go into processed food like Oreos. So, sure, those corporations are facing higher input prices, so they raise prices to compensate for that. But what else has been happening is that corporations have been able to engage in, because they're so large and market concentration is growing, that fewer and fewer firms dominate more and more markets, so there's no competition. There's no, you know, it's not like somebody's going to, you know, reintroduce the Hydrox cookie as a substitute.
I was just thinking
of
Hydrox.
Right? They're not going
to... Yeah. The most unappealing name in a cookie.
No, that's like what that's what I expect to take when I'm sick.
This is the cookie show.
But the fact that corporations face so little competition allow them to raise prices even more than what their input price increases would dictate, and that's what Biden has been calling greedflation.
Right.
That these corporations are able to, like General Mills, Nestle, Coca-Cola, Pepsi, Lay's, and you know Pepperidge Farms falls under one of those umbrellas. I don't know which one it is, but they've been able to increase profits, which makes shareholders and executives very happy. So the rise in grocery prices are U.S. consumers subsidizing corporate executives and wealthy shareholders by paying higher prices because they want higher profits and greater returns on their investment portfolio.
With that, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We'll move on to other topics. We always welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Fran Berman, Jay Jochnowitz, and Aaron Pacitti as... Fran gleefully exclaimed, "It's the cookie show." We'll be back right after this.
There's a rounder at the corner of the bar. Lousy haircut, won't get him too far. Then his cheap cologne.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning for this Friday. It is the 7th of June, and I thank you very much for being with us. It's a great pleasure to have you all with us. We do welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org. Let us talk about another item making news, and we'll go to Fran for the lead on this one. The Justice Department and the Federal Trade Commission agreed to divide responsibility for investigating three major players in the artificial intelligence industry. Federal regulators have reached a deal that allows them to proceed with antitrust investigations into the dominant roles that Microsoft, OpenAI, and NVIDIA played in the artificial intelligence industry, in the strongest sign of how regulatory scrutiny into the powerful technology has escalated. The Justice Department and the FTC, Federal Trade Commission to its friends, struck the deal over the past week, and it is expected to be completed in the coming days, according to two people with knowledge of the matter. Under the arrangement, the Justice Department will take the lead in investigating whether the behavior of NVIDIA, the biggest maker of AI chips, has violated antitrust laws. The FTC will play the lead role in examining the conduct of OpenAI, which makes the ChatGPT chatbot, and Microsoft, which has invested $13 billion in OpenAI and made deals with other AI companies, according to those speaking on this issue. How confusing is this, Fran?
Isn't it a sign of the times, Joe, that you cannot read a newspaper, a periodical, a newsletter without the word AI coming up a million times? This is actually good news. And it's good news for a variety of reasons. First of all, in my humble opinion, the U.S. has been pretty lame about legislation that starts to rein in the risks of AI. The European Union recently passed the AI Act, which is a groundbreaking piece of legislation that says if AI is going to be used in something that can put you at danger, a self-driving car, for example, we want to scrutinize it. We want to make sure that people are okay. And so they're looking at AI that's in the category of critical infrastructure and AI that's at high risk, and they start to put some rules on this. The U.S. has been behind on this. We're investing in it. We're studying it. We haven't made rules yet. So the fact that the FTC and the Justice Department want to start looking at antitrust issues is a good thing. It means that we want to get ahead of, you know, AI is really, we're building the boxcar as we go down the tracks, but we at least want to look at where the tracks are going. And then we want to make sure that the boxcar is going to be safe for us as it goes down those tracks. And so this kind of agreement lays the groundwork for legislation about antitrust that will be important. So why is antitrust important? And one thing that it's really useful to know is that AI is a big player game. ChatGPT and all these other AI models, you kind of can't really do them accurately and well without supercomputers and months and trillions of data sets with trillions of items in it and a lot of money. And so it's really only the big player that can produce this really groundbreaking kinds of products and systems for AI, the large language models, the neural nets. Those are things that only big players can do. And what they're doing is taking really good ideas from small startups and companies, and they're kind of annexing them. And so this sort of feeds that. So the antitrust legislation is important because it says there can't just be big players bossing around the world and creating robot overlords, not to put too fine a point on it. and that's important. On the other hand, the economics of this, my economics friends, will be hard because it's hard for a small company to get off the ground. They don't really have the resources unless they pair up with one of these big companies to actually run these models. And we're starting to see some kind of odd partnership models, like the one between OpenAI, which is the people who brought you ChatGPT, and Microsoft, which is funding them and, you know, is involved in 49% of their support. So it's a little complicated, as things in the tech world always are. But this at least gives us a first step. We can start scrutinizing who's involved, what their relationships with each other are. Are they dominating the whole thing or not? And start at least going somewhere with that.
So this question will either come off as incredibly insightful or horribly naive, and I'm not sure which. But I'm going to go with naive. I'm going to go with naive. But so you look at the government, the federal government is looking at these three companies. These three. Obviously, these three companies are not the only three. So what is it about these three, and doesn't that give, I don't know, as they're being investigated, the other companies sort of a chance to catch up with whatever direction the investigation will eventually lead them to?
Well, Joe, as usual, that's a brilliant question.
Thank you.
Why these three companies? It's for most of us, it's hard to talk about AI without talking about ChatGPT and the spectacularly interesting and sometimes discouraging responses that you get from it. The fact is, ChatGPT has been amazingly on par for some things and amazingly off par for others. And so it's hard to talk about this without talking about ChatGPT, and OpenAI has really been a leader in that. Microsoft had the wisdom to really invest in OpenAI and really take them to a new level. So it's not, and they are a key partner. So it's not surprising that OpenAI and Microsoft would be on the list. NVIDIA makes chips. And remember, we talked about the supercomputing power needed to run these AI models. And these AI models, for my friends, the geeks out there, most of them are neural networks. Those neural networks they have a lot of different layers. You train them over and over and over again on massive amounts of data. And it takes a lot of computing power to do that. And so you want the computers to run as fast as possible, to be as efficient as possible. In my younger days, I used to run a supercomputing center, and I cannot tell you what the resource demands were to do the most resource-intensive programs. And there are programs that, you know, run rockets and figure out how to do bridges and really understand what your options are for drug discovery. These are really massive computers. And so NVIDIA makes the chips for those computers. And so it's really important to include them in that, because now we're talking about the supply chain as well as the outcomes.
Jay?
Yeah, this is going to be a bit of a roundabout answer, but or a roundabout observation. So we just bought a new computer for my wife. Her old one fried. And this one came with Windows 11 Home S mode. And S mode is a protective mode that Microsoft insists be on your computer. And you can take it off. But what it does is they say it helps it run faster, better, stronger. It's sort of like the Bionic Man. What it also does is it does not allow you, sort of like Apple, it does not allow you to download anything and put it on the computer that isn't a Microsoft-approved product. So, for example, Firefox is the browser she uses, the browser I like. We could not put that on the computer. So, supposedly, with a click of a button, you can go to Microsoft Store and get S mode off your computer. I was told that when I purchased it. It took a full day, we're talking 24 hours of clicking a button to try to get this to work. I had to go to Acer. I had to go to Microsoft. I finally put in a request. Call me, Microsoft. I was trying to find Bill Gates' phone number. I was that close to tracking him down and say, Bill. But we finally, this morning, after I put in that request, bingo, the thing was done in all of 30 seconds. What I noticed about this, and this goes to what something that Fran brought up in the, it is kind of an abstract when we say data sets. In a very real sense, I think what Microsoft wants is for everyone to use its Edge browser and everyone to, provide the data that its AI needs and that it needs, just as Facebook wants our data and eBay wants our data and Instagram and all those. All this is built on us. And it's fascinating. I've been using a little bit of AI. Hearst has its own in-house AI program, and we recently did some training on it. And it's useful. It has its limitations. It has its flaws. But the fact that our data, us, everything about us that we do and say, that our phones are listening to, that our computers are registering, is building into this. I think that's the, that's the concrete of all this abstraction. What is it? Understanding what it's all about and understanding where we're headed with this and what is the implication of antitrust, of an antitrust situation?
Well, it's more discouraging than that, because it used to be, well, it still is true, that everybody wants your data so they can market to you. They want your clicks. They want your attention. They want your data. They really want you to basically make them more profitable.
Yes.
But now they also want their data to train AI.
Yeah.
Because that's how AI learns. It has to be trained. And we're actually running out of things to train AI on. They're talking about synthetic data, data that AI makes up to train itself, which, it's hard to imagine what kind of dysfunctionality that's going to bring you. And then you're also seeing the creatives and other folks say, hey, you're using my data, and I'm not getting any compensation for it. New York Times has a big lawsuit against OpenAI and Microsoft for using New York Times articles to train AI. Why does that matter? Well, for example, they use things by Wirecutter. And if you look at, best desk lamps or best hiking boots or something like that in Wirecutter, and then they give you like four choices on what they are, and then they say, click here and you can buy them. Well, they get a little bit of money every time you click there and try to buy them. And when AI scrapes that data, it doesn't include the links. So the New York Times doesn't get that little bit of money. So the New York Times is unhappy about that. They're saying, you're taking our stuff and we're not getting any credit for it. So the economics of this is incredibly complicated.
I do need to pause there, and we'll take a break, and then when we come back, we'll finish up the show. My thanks to all of you for being so great. We are going to take your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We'll be right back.
There's a quiet between the beats of the heart till another one comes. It's a moment like a dawn just before another rising sun. And there's a baby crying just 'cause he's hungry, and another one's alone, and a mother weeps with joy while another one moans. I don't worry about
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and our panel discussion this morning. Fran Berman, Jay Jochnowitz, and Aaron Bassetti. We welcome you, panel, at WAMC.org. 7 or 8 minutes to go. So I ask Aaron Bassetti if it's possible for him to quickly discuss. I mean, we were talking about this a moment ago, but just bringing it into with, because we never use the term greedflation. And I would like to use that term. It is a term being used in the New York Times, a moniker about corporate price increases that has bolstered some Democratic senators. And now the president is being encouraged to lean in on the issue for his economic messaging. Is it all about greed?
It's the economy, stupid. It's not all about greed. As I mentioned earlier, the rise in inflation has a fairly complicated history over the past 4 years. There were COVID supply chain bottlenecks, shifts in consumer purchasing habits, pent-up the lockdown, and then the release of that pent-up demand, Putin's invasion of Ukraine, which roiled energy and grain markets. So it's complicated, and that is not going to fly on the campaign trail. That's fine to discuss in a forum like the Roundtable, which is why you should all donate to WAMC to get the underlying story around all of these things. But on the campaign trail...
Nicely done.
Thanks. On the campaign trail, you know, undecided voters in swing states want to hear the meat and potatoes issue. You know, most of them know Trump is a threat to democracy. He's, been... he is now a convicted felon and all of these other things. Climate change is happening before our eyes. And again, I'm biased because I'm an economist, but I think what a lot of people care about is pocketbook issues. And it's important to note the history. Since 1980, since the move from, more Keynesian full employment policies to pro-wealthy neoliberal supply-side policies, 90% of the population has been pushed to the edge of a cliff. So between 1980 and 2000, they got pushed from maybe 100 feet to 20 feet. And then over the past 20 years, they got pushed from that 20 feet maybe to 5 feet. And then when COVID hit and you saw this rise in inflation that was really eroding the purchasing power of people's income, it pushed them right to the edge. People can see over the edge of that cliff now, and it's not pretty. It's default on your mortgage. It's default on your auto payments. It's I can't pay my credit card. I can't send my kid to college. I can't afford groceries and medicine. So what Biden should be doing, and Sherrod Brown and a lot of other Democratic congresspeople who are running, is taking on this populist message. And it was clear in 2016 that, and I will give Trump credit for reintroducing and Bernie Sanders for reintroducing populism to a political debate. Trump is not a populist. All of his policies are pro-wealthy, anti-worker. What Biden needs to do is latch on to that swing in voter ideology and talk about populist issues, right? The issues that affect their pocketbook. So he should be talking about what we were talking about with antitrust policy and regulatory policy with AI, but talk about it for the big food companies. Call them out by name. Let consumers know that the Justice Department and the Federal Trade Commission is investigating General Mills and Coca-Cola for anti-competitive practices. Tell voters that he will pass labor law that will make it easier for them to join a union. Tell them that he will try to reshore a lot of jobs that were lost due to globalization. He will regulate automation and artificial intelligence so that workers have more job security and not less job security. He'll raise the minimum wage. He will impose higher taxes on, create a millionaires and a billionaires tax bracket. Nobody else has to worry about higher taxes unless you're a millionaire or wealthier. And use that money to fund programs like subsidized education, more stringent enforcement of antitrust violations and so on, fund the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and so on. Voters would respond to that. Let them know that he sees their pain and he's going to do something about it. instead of, you know, talking about Donald Trump is a threat to democracy, that's important. That's not going to win the race.
All right. We have 1 minute left. Who would like it? Jay.
I have nothing to add to what Alan said. I think it was Aaron said it, it was. I think it was. It's exactly what it is. These pocketbook issues, I think, are what we is what's really missing. That Biden just is having a hard time connecting with voters because, you know, he talks about. I mean, I like all the things he talks about. I love green energy. I love but I also cringe when I go to the supermarket and I realize that I am paying a lot more and I can afford it. But, you know, plenty of people are wincing at that. Now, if I still had kids living at home, I would probably be in much more pain than I am now.
Much more wincing.
Yeah. You should take a page out of that rat's book.
Yeah.
There you go.
It was Gilderland. The rat. It was,
it was in Gilderland.
Yeah, the Gilderland rat.
Too bad I didn't have my camera on.
Yes. I want to thank you all for being with us. Very nice to have you all here. We're going to take a break on the roundtable because of the panel, because we're going to be in a fun drive. But the sooner you get us all the money that we need, the sooner we can come back and have a full panel. And you can help us out right now at WAMC.org. Thank you all. Have a great weekend. We'll be back right after this.